Hi, I'm Kathy Forstey, music director at KC Cafe Radio. It's a great pleasure to chat with John Roizat today. John has been a great friend of KC Cafe Radio and was a big help to us at the recent Far West Conference in Oakland, California. But even more than that, it was a pleasure hearing John play live at the conference. John is a multi-instrumentalist and an amazing songwriter. His newest album, Who's That?, has been a mainstay on the Roots Music Report for most of the year. John, I want to thank you again for taking the time to help us at Far West and for also chatting with me today here on KC Cafe Radio.
My pleasure. It was. I love the annual conference. It's just so exciting and it's so exhausting.
Yes.
it's so fun. And it was really nice to meet you and John Dutton in person.
Yeah,
it was very fun.
It was great for us to be able to put real human people with the voices and the names we've been hearing and seeing for the last several years.
Yeah, in a virtual world we live in, huh?
Exactly. For our listeners, tell them a little bit about Far West and what it is and what your involvement was with it.
Sure. Far West is an acronym. It stands for Folk Alliance Region West. And Folk Alliance is a primarily a national, but international in the sense that we have Canada and I think participation from Mexico now. I love saying this. It's a business organization for folk musicians, folk in the broadest sense, in anything from people that do very traditional instrumental stuff like hammered dulcimer tunes, to Americana singer-songwriters with bass and drums. The Western region has a conference every year that moves to different locations within the Western region. The last couple of years, it's been in Oakland, and next year it'll be up in Seattle. And there are four other regions, plus the national organization has an overall conference in your hometown, Kansas mm-hmm. City. Which one of these days I would love to go to. I understand it. It's huge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like Far West, but times 1,000.
Yeah,
pretty
I heard.
Much.
Yeah. I'm still amazed that I can get through the 4 days at Far West. I don't know how you do it with anything bigger.
Yeah, well, hopefully you can take time to enjoy yourself a little
bit
more if you went to the Folk Alliance International. How did you get involved with Far West in the first place?
Oh, geez, I heard about it through a music friend, and my first conference, I think this last conference was my fifth one. So my first one was up in Eugene, Oregon, and then there were two down in Los Angeles, and then the last two in Oakland. And I just got involved in it because I thought it would be a good thing to do, a good way to meet other folk musicians. I had just retired 5 years ago, and I wanted to get back into doing music full time. I've always played music. I did music full time in my 20s, but I decided that I really wanted a better source of income than music provides
right.
for most of us.
Right, exactly.
And I checked out at the Far West conference, and I just thought it was fantastic. I couldn't believe how much fun it was.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't believe how much talent, the breadth in terms of what people were doing. And also I was just wonderfully delighted to find out that people were so friendly and supportive.
Yes.
Just such a great opportunity to meet people who have been making their living doing music all their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And their skill level shows it, and it's inspiring.
Yeah.
To meet and hang out and play with someone like James Lee Stanley,
mm-hmm.
For example. And I'm hooked. And then I got asked to join the board, I think a couple of years ago. Because the organization, the Far West board, did not have any coverage in Northern California. Mm. It was started by a group of people in the Los Angeles area, and there are members who live down at the south end, down San Diego, up in Los Angeles, and some members up in Oregon and Washington, but they asked me if I would join so that mm-hmm. we have some coverage in the San Francisco Bay Area and California. It's just a great group of people.
It really is. And there was people this year from Colorado and Wyoming and Montana and
Arizona.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, there was one woman who comes out from Nashville. She's been out before. So yeah, people come from all over outside of the region.
Yeah, it's great. And I know even Canadians come down and take part too. So yeah.
Yeah, we have part of Canada is in the Western region, and one of our board members is from Vancouver.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's a wonderful group, and the people involved in it are many. I'd say most of the board members are not performers, but they are house concert hosts or otherwise involved in presenting music.
Mm-hmm.
And so I refer to them as the Uber fans.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
So you're from San Francisco. But your music kind of has an Appalachian, Cajun kind of Dust Bowl influence to it. How did those sounds become a part of John Roy's That Sound?
From listening to records back in the old days, I first started playing guitar in high school, and I was listening to Peter, Paul, and Mary and some of the folky stuff then. In college, it was Bob Dylan, and the big discovery for me that just got under my skin was a band called the Holy Modal Rounders, which put out a couple of just fabulous folky albums. They were a duo. I can't quite remember their names. I think Stample and Weber or something like that. One of them was a fingerstyle guitar player, and the other guy played fiddle and also banjo. They sang in this kind of exaggerated, nasally, old-timey voice, kind of imitating the sound of the 78 records.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd never heard that kind of music, so I didn't know what they were imitating. It just sounded so soulful and funky, and I just loved it. And it inspired me to start scratching on the fiddle. Mm-hmm. And I started playing the fiddle inspired by them.
So do you know where they were from?
New York City.
Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
They were part of the Greenwich Village folk scene. Yeah, I don't know where they were originally from. Uh-huh. It's interesting, years later, their first and second albums are still some of my favorite old-time music records. And the quality is really very high in terms of skill level. The fiddle player, God, I wish I could remember his name. I mean, he had a very scratchy, gritty sound, but his intonation, he's playing spot on key. He's mm-hmm. And violin is challenging. You know, it takes a few years before you can play the darn thing in tune.
Right.
And so he had some real skill. He wasn't just faking it.
Were they doing original material, or were they doing like covers, or
they did covers, and then they also would kind of do rewrites.
Mm.
So they kind of a mixture of both, and they went off the deep end with drugs. They got pretty wacky. They put out some additional albums that just sounded more like chaos, stoned out jams. And so they didn't sustain what they were doing, which is kind of a shame. But I don't know. I recommend them if you haven't heard them.
Yeah,
dig them up. Yeah, Holy Modal Rounders. Yeah,
so it's very intriguing.
Yeah, and from them, then I met a friend after college. I kind of was hanging out with like-minded folks up in the Sonoma County Russian River area, which is kind of a mini version of West Virginia, north of San Francisco, and people who were into the original old-time music, the Carter family, Charlie Poole, Grayson and Witter, and those folks, and then listening to that music just got me going. And then hearing some of the Cajun, the Balfa Brothers, D.L. Menard, that stuff. Somehow it just got under my skin. I really loved it.
Yeah, and this was in college that you discovered all this?
Yeah, college and my first few years out of college.
Yeah.
I started taking fiddle lessons from a fiddle player who lived on the Russian River in Sonoma County, and I'd pay him $5 for a fiddle tune. And then I would give him a ride down to the local grocery store where he could buy a gallon of Red Mountain wine. driving back home. So not an inspiring role model, but a good fiddle player, and he got me going.
Yeah, a lot of the great musicians are not necessarily the best people to be hanging out with, but they're incredible musicians.
Yep.
Before that, though, when you were a teenager, you were really into pop music and rock music and
Play guitar. I grew up right as the Beatles and the Beatles broke when I was in middle school. I remember first hearing them, I think, when I was in seventh grade, and then hearing, you know, the Rolling Stones and all the iterations of the Beatles evolved musically in the Stones and all the other British bands, Jerry and the Pacemakers, and then the American bands I remember the high school dances. We had the Turtles come and play the high school dance one time.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it was awesome. I was a military brat, so I moved around quite a bit. And I finished high school in Southern California, and just, the Beach Boys and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so were you writing music during this time, or were you just playing?
No, I didn't have any aspirations to write. I didn't start writing until I was out of college in my early 20s. I was hanging out with some guys who were much more committed, had started sooner playing in bands. And I started playing with them at jam sessions and stuff. And they were writing songs, and good songs. And I was really inspired. And bands break up all the time and reform. And the band, this was four guys from Canada who came down. They were from Toronto originally, and I ended up by playing with three of the four guys. One guy moved back to Canada, but three of them stayed down here for at least a while. I played with all three of them in different iterations, and I learned a lot from them about harmony and working with other musicians and making arrangements and stuff.
So you were more of a band member back in those days?
That's when I started playing with other musicians and decided I really loved music and I wanted to see how far I could go with it.
So you were doing mostly lead or rhythm, or what were you playing?
Both. I played fiddle. I would do fills and leads with fiddle. Fiddle's more of a lead instrument, although you certainly can do rhythm with it too. And I played rhythm guitar. I've worked on my guitar playing a lot over the last five to 10 years. But back then I was mostly chording, just playing the chords, playing the rhythm.
Yeah. Well, being a good rhythm player is a hard job too. So.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a lot to holding down a good groove for the band. Yeah, the guitar fitting in tight with the bass and the drums. Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah. So if you had to pick between fiddle and guitar, which one would you choose if you had to pick?
Oh, well, that's a tough one. You know, they're such different instruments. I guess if I had to pick, I would choose guitar, because you can accompany yourself with guitar. And I love singing. I really got hooked on folk music and all of that through singing, through the words and the songs. And it's hard to, there's not a lot of people who can just accompany themselves solo with fiddle. Bruce Molsky is about the only guy, and John Hartford, of course, did a great job of that too. It'd be guitar. I love playing guitar. And also guitar, you can relax with a guitar. You kind of, settle into a comfortable chair. And with the fiddle, you're holding your arms up and waving them around.
Yeah.
So it's a little more of a workout.
Yeah. But, when we were stuffing the bags there at the Far West Conference, and you guys had your little jam session going on there, that was a lot of fun. It was.
I love it.
Kind of kept us going and getting those bags filled.
I love doing it. It's really fun, I learned that Canadian foot tap stuff that the fiddlers up there do, and it's just, it really is so fun. Yeah, I can see people doing the bag stuffing and kind of skipping and dancing around the table to the rhythm of the music.
It was
a blast.
It was fun. So one of the great things that happened to you in your career was you had the opportunity to have Kate Wolf sing one of your songs, Midnight on the Water. How did that happen?
That was kind of, it's been a wonderful thing, like you said. Well, Kate was living up in the same town that I was living in back in the early 70s, and she was a little farther along in terms of being, first of all, she was very organized. I'm making some assumptions, which I should acknowledge. First of all, she has a lovely, well, had, unfortunately, because she's been gone now for quite a few years, but she had a lovely voice and mm-hmm. just a wonderful way of interpreting a song, a very personal and heartfelt delivery of the songs. And then when she started writing it, she added a lot, that she really had some skills with that too. And so she had made a record when I knew her, and I was not close friends. We would cross paths at jam sessions or music events. I had a good friend that I played music with who knew her and her husband, Don Coffin. And I was over at her house one time. I don't remember the circumstances. She lived about a mile or so from where I lived. And the tune Midnight on the Water was a fiddle tune that had just kind of come out and was being played a lot at Weezer Fiddle Festival. But it's a lovely, lovely waltz. I had learned it, and I was just entranced with the melody, and the title was so evocative. I thought, mm-hmm. Oh, God, wouldn't it be great to write some words to that? And I tinkered with it, and boy, the fates were shining on me. I was working a day job then, and I came home on a lunch break, and I just the words tumbled out. Mm-hmm. And they seemed pretty straightforward, and I thought, well, I don't know. Yeah, it's kind of nice. And then some friends said, oh, no, that's a really nice song you got there. And anyway, I was over at Kate's house, and I showed it to her. We were playing some songs, and I said, well, here's some words I wrote to Midnight on the Water. And she liked it, and she said, oh, gee, that's nice. I'd like to learn that. Can I record it? And she had a little cassette recorder, and mm-hmm. So she recorded it. And I didn't think much more about it than that. And I don't know, a month or two later, it must have been quite a while later, because I was playing five nights a week at a hotel doing in the top 40 band. Mm-hmm. And I got a call at 10 in the morning, and it was Kate saying, hi, it's Kate. Are you doing anything? And I said, well, I'm playing tonight, but not doing anything now. And she said, well, would you be interested in, would you be willing to come out and play the fiddle part on Midnight on the Water? I'm working on my second album, and I really like the way you played the fiddle on it. I was flattered and also a little puzzled, because mm-hmm. Kate was working with had a great band, and had a fabulous fiddle player, Paul Ellis, who really had chops much stronger than mine. And so I was kind of like, well, sure, but what about Paul? And she said, well, I just really like the way you played it. And mm-hmm. so she had rented a beach house out on the Sonoma coast, and I drove out there. The reason that Paul wasn't getting the fiddle sound that I had on the cassette that she liked was because she was playing it in a different key.
Oh.
And fiddle is very, very certain songs you can do in different keys. It really affects the sound you get when mm-hmm. you use open drone strings or not. And so I said, well, you know, it's because I'm doing it in D. And she said, okay, well, I'll sing it in D. And so I was really flattered. And so it was a thrill. It was a thrill recording with her.
Wow. And that was, yeah. It was a great honor for her to include you. I mean,
it was.
She could have just recorded it and told you, hey, I recorded the song.
I would have been thrilled with that too. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. No, she was a wonderful person. She was, I had started writing other songs too, and I showed them to her, and she was real supportive. Mm-hmm. I've stayed in touch with her. She DJed a show on one of the radio stations in the Bay Area, and I came down and did an interview on the show and played a bunch of my other songs. And anyway, yeah, it was really a tragedy when she got sick.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was really very, very sad.
Yeah, we lost a great one there. You had a really active music career, and then you decided to stop and get married and have a quote-unquote normal life.
Yeah.
Did you ever regret giving up music during that time and doing that?
Not really. I mean, I did music full-time enough. I kind of lived the dream, so to speak. I did some touring. I played full-time. It's a tough life. It's really tough if you want to have a family.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't regret the fact that I chose family. And I still played. I've been in bands all my life, always played with other people. I've continued to write songs. And so I've kept my hand in it, so to speak. And, mm-hmm. and I've taken lessons. I've worked on my skills over the years. So, I'm not as far along as if I'd been doing it full time. But I also feel like, I've got a comfortable retirement. And now I can devote myself to music.
Yeah, you can enjoy yourself in that.
Exactly. Without worrying about how I'm going to pay the rent. I mean, you meet people who are amazing musicians who have placed songs that have charted at the top 10. I mean, and they're living hand to mouth.
Yeah.
And guys my age, and that's really a tough row to hoe. I so admire people who do it, who stick with it. I chose an easier path. And I don't regret it. I really enjoyed the other work that I did. I worked for a nonprofit, and I was very proud of the work they did called the Asia Foundation. Yeah, it was great. Yeah, life has been good.
Yeah. So, but you were still doing music during that time, and
yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Did you still go out and do gigs and things too from time to time?
Yeah. It was fun. The president of the Asia Foundation discovered that I played in a band and asked if I'd play for the board meeting. I would gig probably every other month. Mostly I would play in what we call living room bands.
Mm-hmm.
A group of people get together and they work on arrangements and they get out and play a gig every other month or so. But you get together every week and you work on parts you treat it as seriously as you can, but it's definitely a part-time avocation type of activity.
So when you recorded an album a couple of years ago, was that the first album you'd ever done? I mean, had you done anything up to then?
I did, back in the 70s, we had, it was a big deal to have a 4-track tape recorder. I mean, it's a huge deal to have an 8-track tape recorder, but... So we had recorded demos, 4-song demos. We hire a guy to come in and record the band. I've got tapes from gigs back then, studio recording. You were much more limited in terms of what you could do. The recording now, just like everything else, the computer has facilitated and made it so much easier and cheaper to do more elaborate recording work.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. So I didn't record any full-length albums until it was up on the computer.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of a gearhead, so I got into it. I learned the software, and I've always been interested in the microphones and the tech side of the music performing.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was fun, and I recorded. I did an album. Recorded a bunch of my pals and a band I was in, and then the first two albums I did solo and collaborations.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty much collaborations was a compilation of recordings that I had done over the years with different friends, and then the solo I worked with an engineer. And just recorded all of that at his studio.
Mm-hmm.
And then who's that? Who's that? I'm set for life. I can do how's that, who's that, where's that, who's that? So, but anyway, who's that? My most recent one. I worked with a different engineer, and many of these guys who used to have full blown studios have kind of folded up their standalone studio operations and moved their recording into their house, into their mm-hmm. home. There's so much. There's so many people like me who do the tracking, recording the individual tracks in their home studios, and mm-hmm. then want help with the mixing.
Right. Yeah. The mixing and the mastering. Yeah.
Exactly. And mm-hmm. and that I've learned that it's somebody who does mixing all day long has got a lot better ears and a lot better knowledge of their tools and what's possible.
Right.
I like my own tracking now and then, and work with somebody on the mixing, and then obviously the mastering is done by a pro. That's what they do.
Yeah, I had a guy who mastered one of my albums, and he said that, you know, it's good to have fresh ears on a recording, and that's very true. So how would you compare, you kind of alluded to this a little bit in the recording process, but how would you compare having a music career in the 2000s to having a music career back in the 70s and in that time period?
Well, I guess I'd say the possibilities are so much broader now, and the access that you have to the technology is so much better. Like I said, back in the early 70s, if you had access to a four-track tape recorder, that was a pretty big deal. Anything in terms of the sound treatment, like equalization or things like reverb, delay, all the subtleties of compression and all that sort of stuff, that was pretty hard to get at.
Mm-hmm.
You had to be working in a studio. I mean, that was very expensive gear. And far, far more limited than what now you can. I mean, you can buy software for your computer for less than $500, and it's got all of that stuff in it.
Right.
So what you can do now is vastly, vastly more. You can kill yourself with all the possibilities. So you got a lot more options. You got a much broader palette. The other thing is, if you're interested in a song, you want to learn. I've been learning some of Roger Miller songs, and mm-hmm. I was trying to get the remember that song "Dang Me"?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, Roger Miller, it does all these kind of great vocal things, kind of stuff with his guitar, and I was trying, how do you do that? Well, I just went over to YouTube, mm-hmm. and so your access to learning songs is much easier.
Yeah.
And there's software too. There's a great piece of software called the Amazing Slow Downer, mm-hmm. which will slow down a part without changing the pitch. And it's just easy to do. So you just, you can just drop a sound file in it and, slow it down as much as you want to pick apart something.
Yeah.
Look at YouTube and see how someone's doing something live. It was, I remember you wanted to learn a song when I was playing in a top 40 band and you'd catch it on the radio. I mean, having a cassette recorder was a big deal. So mm-hmm. you could record it. And you kind of just listen to the radio all day long and have your cassette recorder handy so that you could catch the song, so that you could record it, so that you could then pick it apart and learn it.
Yeah, or if you could see them on TV, you could see what chords they were playing and go, oh, okay, that's what they're playing there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's why I learned a lot of stuff.
Yeah. And now with YouTube, you can pull up something anytime you want. You can stop it, rewind it back a little bit and do it over and over again until you get it.
Yeah, and for me, I also teach, and one of the great tools I've discovered is something called, it's a website called ProTab. .com and it has hundreds of thousands and thousands of tabs for music, and they've got where it actually has the guitar neck, and it shows you where you play the notes on the neck. It's pretty great, and then it has tablature too as well.
The resources in terms of chords, if you want to learn, there's Chordy.com and Yeah, if you want a lyric, you just type it into Google.
Right.
The other thing is too, there's a lot of support organizations now that bring people together and provide teaching and learning opportunities. There's the Nashville Songwriters Association. There's a West on the West Coast is a West Coast Songwriters Association. There's Folk Alliance. And so there's community now with the email and internet and all that stuff. It's so much easier to find people that are doing what you're doing,
right?
And to get access to resources, you can learn about you can take a songwriting class
from
Berklee School of Music online. You can showcase songs. So the ability to tap into community is wonderful, and I think it's a lot more collaborative. Do you remember the talk that Penny Nichols gave? She was one of the, for your listeners, Penny Nichols has had quite an amazing career, and she was performing and opening for bands like Janis Joplin back in the 60s, and then she went on to get a degree from Harvard in music education, and she's taught a lot. Mm-hmm. And she was talking about how coming up in the 60s, it was so much more competitive.
Yeah.
And from the way she talked about it, it almost sounded like it was ruthless. Really competitive. I find that the music community is so supportive. I get most of my gigs through my connections with other musicians.
Mm-hmm.
I hear about a place or we collaborate on something. That's just a wonderful part of the community to be part of.
Yeah. I mean, that's the way we are here in Kansas City too. A lot of, I kind of help book music for a couple of places here locally and I play there as well. And then I'd say, hey, they're looking for people to play. Why don't you come out and play? And
yeah.
So, it's a good thing.
Yeah.
It's a lot better in that regard. But as far as though, I guess the way music is sold nowadays, it's a lot harder for musicians to try and make money off of their recordings anymore.
It's a huge puzzle. I was talking with the guy that I worked with on radio outreach. I've been charting really, really well. I'm excited about it. So I'm thinking, bragging time. I was number one on the STS internet, one of their country charts, and I've been on RMR, but it doesn't really translate to sales. It doesn't really translate to gigs. It gives me bragging rights. It gives me some credibility when I reach out. But yeah, it's kind of a different world. I remember when to be charting at all was a huge deal back in the day, and you were selling lots of records.
Yeah, I mean, if you had a top 10 record back in the 70s, you were for sure going to have a gold record off of that.
Yeah, it was amazing.
But nowadays it's like, maybe if you're number one for 10 weeks.
Yeah, and I guess it depends on the chart. Certainly the folk charts, that's not a big part of the money side of music.
Yeah, that's the other thing is that there's so many charts nowadays.
Yeah.
It's incredible. I mean, even with like the Grammy Awards, you look at the Grammy Awards and there's like hundreds of categories.
Yeah.
There's like over 100 categories in the Grammys. It's like, do we really need that many categories?
You know? It's kind of an embarrassment of riches.
Music is diverse, but it is music. There's really only two kinds of music, good and bad music. And even that's subjective, I don't really think we need that many charts. We don't need it broken down in that way and categorized and branded. Good music is good music.
Yeah.
So let's talk about Who's That? This is your newest album. When did you record that?
I spent about 2 years working on it. So I released it in February 2015. I'm kind of working back in my mind. So I recorded it in 2013 and 14.
You recorded it at your home studio there? Or?
Both. I had tracks that I had worked on. I'd gotten them so far, and I wasn't really kind of happy with the final result. And so I just kind of parked them. And I had looked around for somebody to work with. I was looking for someone who did a little more production. The guy that I worked with on Solo, Randy Rude, fabulous guy, really like working with him. He's a bit more of a purist. he wants to just get the sound. And that was also what I was after at the time. I really wanted an album that sounded like, you know, what I'd sound like if you come to hear me play as a solo performer. And I wanted to go with Who's That? I figured, well, I've got my solo performer album. I'd like to go with something a little more production, full band kind of a sound. So I started with a guy named Kevin Harris, and I heard about him through a couple of people that I'd met from Far West, who had local to my area, in East Bay, Berkeley, greater Berkeley area. So I went over and met the guy, and I really liked him. He's one of the few people I know that supports himself fully on music. He does a lot of soundtracks now. He's a fabulous musician, excellent guitarist, plays bass, keyboard, sings really well. I mean, he's been supporting himself since high school playing music. So anyway, I started working with him and just trying it out on a song, and I really liked working with him. And then, so I've been, in 2013, I've been recording my own tracks, and then I started working with Kevin in 2014. It's addicting. You know, you just get so involved, and the meter's running. I really need to be efficient about this. Uh-huh. But then you get into it, and the possibilities, you get it's almost, but not quite. And so, anyway.
Yeah. So, are you one of those types who you're never quite satisfied with it?
I'm pretty fussy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I can be the same way.
Yeah, you get so down deep into the details of stuff, and the details matter. But yeah, you can lose perspective too. It's really helpful to work with somebody else.
Yeah, you can let the details eat you up sometimes.
Oh man, it can sure eat your budget.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you had a really good time recording this album. There's a lot of really fun songs on it.
Oh, thanks.
One of my favorites is Gasoline and Guitar Strings.
Oh, thanks.
Can you tell me what that song's about?
Well, it's a story of being a singer-songwriter.
Yeah.
It's a fun one to sing. Yeah, and certainly I relate to it. It's pretty much autobiographical. I remember the excitement of writing a song that people respond to. And your friend is telling you that, oh, you should copyright that, and boy, you should get that to you. You should send that to so and so, and all of that kind of first time songwriter thrill, and discovering that it's a lot longer road. The overnight sensation is it happens in a movie maybe,
yeah.
But it doesn't really happen in real life. Even the young stars they've got a lot of clout, a lot of stuff behind them. And so it's that settling into doing it because you love it. You know, first you're like, the pie in the sky, I'm going to make lots of money, and this song's so wonderful. And then realizing that there's a million wonderful songs out there, and there's a whole business side to it too, that if you're in it for the long haul, do it because you like doing it.
Yeah, do it for the love of the music.
Exactly. Yeah. And then whatever good stuff happens in terms of money, recognition, that's just gravy.
And another one of my favorites is A Church-Going Man. Is that about anyone in particular?
I wrote that. It's inspired by, I've got some pals that I, it's kind of my just let it all hang out jam session buddies. And playing music, it can be a very spiritual experience when you're playing with other people and you're working so closely together, and you're creating this beautiful sound that is just a moment in time. And so the song was inspired by this group of people I've been playing with pretty much every week. I met them in the late 80s, and we've been playing these together, not in a band, just getting together and playing. There's about 10 people. Any night, the group can range in size from 2 or 3 to up to 10.
Mm-hmm. What's the makeup? Is there like guitar, fiddle, banjo?
A lot of guitars, acoustic guitar, always had a bass player. There's a guy who comes who's a wonderful harmonica player. Another guy comes with a dobro. There's a gal who plays accordion. I'm playing fiddle a lot of the time, although sometimes I'm playing guitar. Yeah, am I leaving any instruments out? We don't have a banjo in the group, unfortunately.
Well, maybe you need to pick up the banjo.
Banjo in the lyric.
Yeah.
Or rhyme. We don't have piano either.
Well, maybe you need to pick up the banjo and add that to it.
I've tried. You know, it's a little bit different. I play a little bit of mandolin. I think if I'm going to do anything else, I'll work on mandolin.
Yeah. And then another song I want to ask you about, it's one of the most beautiful songs I've heard in a while, is called A Promise and a Rose. Tell me about that song. It's such a pretty song.
Oh, thanks. First of all, I think, credit to my duet partner on the album, Irina Spiritu, who is a lovely, lovely voice, and she has her own music career.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hopefully we'll be playing her on Casey Cafe Radio soon.
Yeah, good. And for your listeners, Irene, she has a very unusual spelling. It's A-I-R-E-N-E, Irene. She's Filipino-American, so maybe that's the source of the spelling of Irene. But anyway, the song was, I just got this image of a guy promise, that he had to leave his girlfriend to be promised to return. It's just a classic image in literature and songs. I got a melody that I liked working with, and some songs just tumble out, and some songs are kind of a journey. You're not quite sure. You get a little fragment of it, and you just work with it. And it's just kind of like, like you're knitting a sweater or something. You're not quite sure how it's going to turn out. Or maybe if you knit a sweater, I'm not a knitter, so maybe you have to know what you're going to do. But you're fitting together pieces, and so the story, so I just had the story. And then at about the time that I wrote it, I've been reading Willa Cather. One of my all-time favorite books was My Antonia, and I read some of her other books too. And so I kind of had that setting of the prairie and the pioneer days, and and I think in the floating around in the subconscious, and that really influenced the storyline of the song.
Yeah, it's a beautiful song.
And thank you.
Very well performed too. Here's my final question for you: does Who's That answer the question of who you are as an artist?
Oh, that's a great question. I think so. I think it's a pretty broad spectrum. There are aspects. I don't think I did much Cajun stuff on Who's That. I got more Cajun stuff on collaborations. So yeah, it covers a big part of it, and I like to think that I'm learning and changing and adding and dropping and
Yeah, well, it's a great album, and I really enjoyed hearing it and listening to it, and we're really enjoying playing it on Casey Cafe Radio.
Well, I sure appreciate your interest and support of it, that's for sure. You make the music to share with people. You make it because you love it, and something you love, you want to share with people.
That's what it's all about.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Let's tell everybody where they can find you and find your music. Your website is royzat.com.
Yep, R-O-Y-Z-A-T, which is a play on my last name. Yeah.
Your music's available on iTunes and SoundCloud, is that correct?
Yeah, I've got all my stuff on SoundCloud. You can find it on Spotify, iTunes, Amazon.
And then you're also on Facebook, so people can find you there.
Yeah.
And you've got a terrific blog, too, as well. Tell people about your blog real quick.
Oh, yeah, thank you. I've been writing a monthly newsletter. A friend of mine, when I started out and wanted to get more back into music full time, said, well, times have changed. You got to get on Facebook and you got to start writing a blog. And I thought, huh? And so I started writing a blog, and pretty soon I realized that it was pretty boring to just write about myself. And it was a lot more fun to write about bands that I hear, because I'm out and about. I circulate quite a bit, and I hear some music, or someone tells me about somebody, or I see something on Facebook from the web. So I'll pick it up from anywhere. But I like putting in music that I've discovered during the past month. And also sometimes I'll put in tips for other musicians. There's a guy who writes a blog on the music industry called Ari's Take. He's a young guy. He's very, very much into what's going on with new music and the evolution of the industry, which is just fascinating right now. It's just changing so much. So anyway, I write this blog. I've been doing it now for about 3 years, I think. And I got an email from Daryl Hanger, who's a God's gift to violin. I mean, God, he's a violin player. I mean, he kept saying hi and check out my I'm coming to town, and if you want to put it in your blog, that would be great. and said, wow, I guess I've arrived.
That's neat.
Yeah, I was very excited.
So, when your heroes start contacting you, that's cool.
Exactly. Yeah, it was pretty thrilling. And I've got one of the nice clubs to hear acoustic music asked if they could start using some of my blog in their monthly. So, great. Yeah, it's fun. I'll keep doing it. It keeps me inspired. Yeah.
Yeah. So check out that blog. It's John Roy Zatt. You can find it from your website. I think you can.
It's on my website. I call it the Music News You Can Use.
So go to royzatt.com and check out that blog. And then you can also find his music on SoundCloud, Spotify, and iTunes. And then you can also friend him on Facebook and find out everything that John's up to, which is
Thanks,
a lot.
Yeah. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you again for taking the time to chat with me, and thank you one more time for all the help at Far West. We couldn't have done it without your help.
Oh, so. It's my pleasure. It was so great to have you guys, and I hope you're not too worn out to do it again next year.
Well, we're thinking about it.
So. Yeah, it's a lot of work, and it'll be up in Seattle, so a little farther away.
But. Yeah, well, I like Seattle. It's a good town. So.
Oh, good.
Yeah, been there a couple times. So.
And I've got to get over to your town.
Yes, you got to come to Kansas City and do Far West, or not Far West, Folk Alliance, I mean, and check that out and see what we have here in Kansas City, too. We got a lot of great things going on musically here, too. So
yeah, I would love to.
Well, thanks again, John. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks a lot.